You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. London Grad is Falling Down, by Willem Marks. In the wake of the Ukraine invasion, what will be the fate of Russian money in the UK? Opening photo shows a high-end property that is being occupied by demonstrators, with a banner from the balcony that says, "This property has been liberated." In the early hours of March 14th, a small group of men, dressed mostly in black, pried open an entrance to one of London's grandest mansions, triggering its alarm system. The six-story residence, with a white stucco frontage, sits on a highly trafficked 19th-century development that has for decades housed various viscounts, earls, and dukes. Not far from Buckingham Palace, the Palace of Westminster Parliament Building, and an archway commemorating Britain's victory over Napoleon, the property shares a prestigious zip code with the embassies of Spain, Portugal, Germany, Austria, Turkey, and Norway. Once the home of Britain's Secretary of State for War and the Colonies, 5 Belgrave Square has more recently been one of several London outposts for a rather different but no less acquisitive sort of empire, that of Russian wealth. The intruders called themselves London Makhnovists after an early 20th century anarchist who sought to create a stateless society in what is now Ukraine. However, the target of their protest was not a state per se, but the 2003 purchaser of the building, with its list price of $39 million. Oleg Deripaska, a trained physicist who founded aluminum giant Rusal, is one of a handful of extremely rich Russian businessmen to have snapped up plum properties in the British capital. And so, just a few weeks after Moscow's forces had parachuted into Kyiv, and millions of Ukrainians began pouring across the borders of Eastern Europe, the anarchist decided the vast, empty Belgrave Square property would be ideally suited to house refugees. They hung banners from its facade, a sky blue one asserting this property has been liberated, and a red one exhorting the Russian President Vladimir Putin to go F himself. Their actions channeled a coalescing sense among ordinary citizens in various Western nations that the wealth of Russia's elite businessmen, often built on the back of state-owned enterprises, should no longer be a welcome import. In the UK, that view has coincided with an extraordinary shift at the heart of the establishment, in recent months, concentrating the firepower of the justice system, finance ministry, and other levers of the state at several Russian individuals with alleged ties to Putin, after cosseting them for the past 2 decades with all the comforts, perks, and privileges the British capital and its political class has to offer. The men in question, for they have almost always been men, have wrapped their arms around soccer clubs, country estates, celebrity friendships, and society column inches. Roman Abramovich, a one-time Deripaska business partner, bought a vast mansion just yards from Kensington Palace, around the corner from the Russian embassy, for well over $100 million. While still in college, documents show the Russian foreign minister's stepdaughter, Polina Kovaleva, paid $6 million cash for her swish London apartment in a luxury new build. She has detailed her glamorous life of yachts, swimming pools, and sunny days in Kensington on Instagram. These real estate swoops have earned London the moniker Moscow on Thames, with oligarchs' kids populating the city's more prestigious schools and clubby society haunts. The wives, girlfriends, and mistresses shop at Harrods, frequent the Serpentine Gallery, and seek record-breaking divorce settlements in British courts. Practically overnight, their financial and physical assets, along with their social capital, have been put on ice. Some object that innocent individuals with no ties to the Kremlin and their political donations have been unfairly identified amid the fervor. Yet in interviews with Vanity Fair, more than a dozen activists, politicians, and former government ministers lament that it took such dire events to trigger these actions. And several questioned how long the budding allergy to Russian wealth can possibly last, particularly where the governing Conservative Party is concerned. Either way, in Belgrave Square, the city's Metropolitan Police had not received the memo. Within several hours, almost a dozen of its vehicles were stationed outside the property, with some 200 officers involved at a cost of more than $100,000. Following a drawn-out period of door breaches, clashes atop a cherry picker, and harnessed hard hats haplessly attempting to scale a balcony, the protesters were forcibly removed. They had by then found a basement full of booze, no food, and captured video of opulent interiors, with furniture from a company founded by David Linley, also known as the Earl of Snowdon, Queen Elizabeth's nephew, along with so much stuff that a normal human being shouldn't have, as one anarchist remarked to a journalist. The Machnovist left no damage, but four were arrested for squatting. Deripaska, an absentee landlord, appeared displeased, and far from eager to be identified as the landlord at all. He insisted through a representative that it was in fact members of his family who owned 5 Belgrave Square. British Land Registry documents identify the home's legal owner as a company called Ravalot Limited, registered in the British Virgin Islands. But a UK High Court ruling in 2007 recorded the Belgrave Square house as belonging to Deripaska, and there are no indications its title deed has been transferred since. His spokesperson said the family was appalled at the negligence of Britain's justice system shown by Boris Johnson's cabinet in introducing the sanctions and colluding with the sort of people who raid private property. Back in February, Deripaska had predicted there would be no invasion of Ukraine. After Russia's assault, he called for peace talks. By late March, he called the conflict a madness, in which all sides are recklessly gearing for a long-term war that will have tragic consequences for the entire world. But when UK authorities targeted his assets, he lashed out, declaring there is not a single fact in support of Boris's cabinet's fantasies. Forget Robert Mueller III's inquiry into the links between Kremlin figures and Donald Trump's presidential campaign. The complex, intertwined relationship between Russian billions and modern Britain goes far beyond high-priced real estate. Successive Conservative prime ministers, from David Cameron to Theresa May to Boris Johnson, have been obliged to respond to repeated geopolitical provocations, including Crimea's 2014 annexation and the 2018 poisoning of a former Russian spy living in Salisbury. But at the same time, each has sought to avoid the kind of overt criticism that might impair their valuable relationships with a small coterie of wealthy political donors of Russian origin. February's invasion of Ukraine made that already precarious tightrope nigh impossible to walk, however, and in the months since, government ministers have lined up to promote their anti-Putin bona fides with weapons shipments to Ukraine, yacht impoundings, property seizures, and bank freezes. The UK's transport secretary, who famously fell victim to his own department's COVID-related travel policies while on a family vacation, recently arrived at a London dock, news crew in tow, to publicize the detention of a superyacht called Phi. He said the vessel, with an infinite wine cellar and freshwater pool, had been mired in all sorts of layers of almost deliberate, we think, in fact, deliberate attempts to hide its true ownership. The conservative government's recent crackdown masked an insidious malaise, with a number of Russian chickens coming home to roost. As a Belgrave Square protester told reporters before police arrested him, the same money that funds the Russia war machine funds the Conservative Party. That particular charge has proven deeply uncomfortable for Johnson and his conservatives, who have for years lagged behind the United States in imposing sanctions on high-profile Russians. As Prime Minister, Cameron repeatedly promised to unmask the beneficial ownership behind foreign shell companies that, on paper, own thousands of luxurious London properties. The idea was subsequently debated, recommended by various committees, and ultimately shelved for years before the Economic Crime Act was passed in a rush in March. If you've got deep pockets and you bought, I don't know, Sutton Place or some great big aristocratic mansion because you're just about the only kind of person who can afford to keep it up to its Downton Abbey kind of standards, then you can invite everybody around and have the whole Gosford Park dinner party, says Chris Bryant, the former deputy leader of the House of Commons and a pro-transparency campaigner in Parliament. You'll get actors and celebrities and football stars, and I mean anybody you want that will join your salon. And prime ministers, and prime ministers, and Nigel Farage. Many members of the Russian emigratsiya community in Britain are simply well-to-do people who chose to leave after the Cold War ended. London was convenient for its time zone, language, and private schools. But in 1994, Margaret Thatcher's conservative successor, John Major, introduced a new immigration category for individuals who brought £1 million into the country, investing at least £750,000 of it in bonds, or stocks, or loans tied to actively trading UK businesses. The rest they could use to buy property, for example, or deposit in banks. These golden visas, as they became known, encouraged the wealthiest demographic, Russian and otherwise, to go shopping. And because almost all of today's great Russian fortunes are derived directly or indirectly from former or current state enterprises or assets, that did pose a potential security risk, says Dominic Grieve, the UK's former Attorney General. It meant that there were people who are now integrated into the United Kingdom. Some of them have taken dual nationality, who, in fact, have, because of their economic interest, ties to Russia, which can be exploited by the Russian state. Next photo, Evgeny Lebedev and current Conservative Party, well, at least at the writing of this article, he was the Conservative Party leader, Boris Johnson. And this picture is from a 2009 reception at the Royal Opera House. In the early years of Putin's reign, the threat perhaps didn't feel like one. Tony Blair's government even loosened the threshold for these foreign investors further, allowing them to use borrowed money. Russians applying from outside the country were granted visas in larger numbers than any other nationality within a few years of that change. In August 2008, one of Blair's closest advisors, Peter Mandelson, accepted an invitation from Deripaska to visit his magnificent 238-foot yacht, the Queen Kay, now known as Clio, freshly refurbished and anchored off the coast of Corfu. By then, Mandelson had been forced twice out of Blair's cabinet. The first time, after accepting a secret loan from a colleague And later, amid allegations he had supported the UK passport application of an Indian billionaire in a convoluted quid pro quo, though a subsequent inquiry found Mandelson had wielded no improper pressure. Nothing, if not a survivor, he was named to Parliament's unelected upper chamber, the House of Lords, as Baron Mandelson of Foy in the county of Herefordshire and Hartlepool in the county of Durham. He's publicly insisted on plain old Lord Mandelson. Back in 2008, he was the European Trade Commissioner, making decisions about the bloc's tariffs on imported materials, such as aluminum. That rendered his choice to spend time on the Queen Kay of natural interest to Britain's political press. His spokesman explained his presence by saying the two men had been on holiday in the same area and it was purely a social occasion. As Mandelson yacht sprawled in Greece, a close friend of future Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron also came aboard the Queen Kay. It was one of four encounters over several days between Deripaska and George Osborne, a striver born to become the 18th Baronet of Ballintaylor and Ballylemon, and later Britain's finance minister from 2010 to 2016. He was accompanied by yet another Cameron friend, Andrew Feldman, at the time the chief executive of the Conservative Party and chief fundraiser. The social maven behind this slightly surprising menage was the future Baron Rothschild, Nathaniel, himself a pal of Osborne's from their Oxford days, who had reportedly run out of space for Mandelson in his family villa and so billeted him on the Russian's yacht. Incensed by the media reports of Mandelson's presence on the yacht, for which he appeared to fault Osborne, Rothschild wrote a detailed letter to the London Times, alleging that Osborne and Feldman had boarded the boat to solicit a donation from Deripaska. Rothschild noted that, following the meeting, Feldman had suggested, since the magnate was not a British citizen, any political donation would need to be channeled through one of Mr. Deripaska's British companies, which would have been illegal. The Conservative Party defended Feldman, stating he had not met Deripaska previously and was not aware who he was. It added that there was no discussion about how a donation could be channeled. Rather, Feldman gave his regular explanation of UK trading companies making political donations. It would be better, Rothschild concluded, in a shot across Osborne's bow, if all involved accepted the age-old adage that private parties are just that. Osborne insisted no further action had been pursued. The Prime Minister at the time, Gordon Brown, then no friend of Mandelson's, said the episode demanded investigation, but Cameron stood behind Osborne. Like Johnson and Rothschild, both had belonged to Oxford University's Bullingdon Club. Photographs of them dressed in the Society's $1,000 bespoke tailcoats, combined with a tableau of a Russian-owned mega-yacht to permanently stain Osborne's political reputation. Although Deripaska's political donations may have ultimately proven unpalatable, another member of Cameron and Osborne's Conservative cabinet was later happy to accept multi-million-dollar paychecks from the aluminum czar. Greg Barker, also known as the Right Honorable, the Lord Barker of Battle, or Baron Barker. Ever since Cameron rewarded his loyalty with a lifetime sinecure in the House of Lords, has worked with Russian businesses and billionaires off and on for decades. In 2017, he took on the independent chairmanship of Deripaska's company, N Plus Group, before its founder was placed under U.S. sanctions. In 2019, he became executive chairman and only resigned amid the furor following the Ukraine invasion. Prior to his N Plus resignation, Barker had noted that N Plus is a very international company with a big operation in Ukraine. Whatever the optics, the fact is I have a real responsibility for thousands of employees on the ground right now in Ukraine, I will not shirk that responsibility and walk away when there is fighting just miles from our plant there. Last year, Osborne reportedly used his relationship with Barker to win unpaid advisory work with N+ for an investment bank, where he is now a partner. Prior to that, after stepping down as finance minister, and despite minimal journalism experience, Osborne had scored the top editorship at London's major newspaper, The Evening Standard, owned by Evgeny Lebedev, whose father had served, like Putin, in the KGB. In 2012, Lebedev's paper had supported Johnson's second term as London mayor. In 2020, Johnson nominated Lebedev for a peerage, and with the new title, a lifelong membership in the House of Lords, with its signature mix of donors, grandees, and hereditary aristocrats. Baron Lebedev of Hampton in the London borough of Richmond upon Thames and of Siberia in the Russian Federation has yet to vote or speak in a single debate. MI5 and MI6 have each reportedly raised concerns that Lebedev's participation in Parliament might constitute a security threat. As a consequence, opposition lawmakers and even some members of Johnson's own party demanded in late March that the agency's advice be declassified. Johnson's government missed the deadline, then weeks later put out a tiny smattering of largely irrelevant documents and withheld the rest from the public on grounds of national security. Lebedev, who won UK citizenship in 2010, also issued a statement in March in one of his own papers. His holdings include The Independent, too, insisting he was British to the core. "I am not a security risk to this country, which I love," he wrote. In May, the Canadian government sanctioned Lebedev's father as either a Russian oligarch or close associate of one who had directly enabled Vladimir Putin's senseless war in Ukraine. Next photos. Roman Abramovich, who sold his Chelsea football club as government scrutiny increased. Beechwood House, valued at $64 million, is the subject of a sanctions spat. Vladimir Putin speaks with Oleg Deripaska, an aluminum oligarch, at the International Investment Forum in Sochi in 2008. Funds from other Russian-born British residents turned citizens have flowed easily into conservative coffers in recent years. Lubov Chernikin, the Russian-born wife of a former deputy finance minister and state bank chairman Vladimir Chernikin, has been especially generous. Among women, she is the party's second highest donor, contributing the equivalent at press time of nearly $2.7 million. For context, the Conservatives reported taking in around $22 million from publicly disclosed donors around the last general election in 2019. In 2004, Deripaska and Rothschild had helped her husband find his feet in London, where he was able to obtain a work visa. The Chernikins eventually gained British citizenship several years later, and both Theresa May and Cameron subsequently participated in fundraising efforts that attracted her donations, which began a few years after she married Vladimir in 2007. In 2019, Liz Truss, who is now Britain's foreign secretary and has loudly trumpeted a new series of sanctions since early March, posted a picture of May and the blonde Mrs. Chernikin, who had ponied up around $175,000 to dine with a handful of senior conservative female Pauls at a hotel just a stone's throw from Buckingham Palace. Chernikin had paid even more than that in 2014 to play tennis with Cameron and Johnson, at the time Prime Minister and London Mayor, respectively. Following Russia's annexation of Crimea, Cameron faced criticism for accepting that donation. He argued at the time that Mrs. Chernikin, by then a British citizen, was not a crony of Putin, so keeping the donation was the right approach. Recently, Leila Moran, a lawmaker from the Liberal Democrat opposition party, said that decision should be reversed and all such funds returned. It's just the right thing to do right now, she told Vanity Fair, amid general criticism of these donations. Chernikin's lawyers have repeatedly said her money has nothing to do with the Kremlin, nor is Vladimir Chernikin linked to Putin or the Kremlin in any way. A Deutsche Bank document, known as a suspicious activity report, submitted to the U.S. Treasury, shows that a potential shell company registered in the British Virgin Islands initiated a 2016 funds transfer worth $8 million to Chernikin's husband. According to the document, first leaked to BuzzFeed News, the BVI firm was controlled by the children of a billionaire member of the Russian Parliament's upper chamber, Suleyman Kerimov, who provided their funding. Deutsche Bank's risk team flagged it in the suspicious activity report, since Chernikin was a politically exposed person, and because the commercial purpose of the transactions and the relationship between the parties could not be determined. Kerimov has denied any dealings with Mrs. Chernikin. The Chernikin's representatives said it was a short-term commercial loan that was swiftly repaid, that Mrs. Chernikin never directly or indirectly received money from Kerimov, and that donations to the conservatives derived from her own funds. Since then, Kerimov has been placed under UK and US sanctions. At press time, the Fed successfully seized a $325 million yacht, believed to be his, after it was moored for months in Fiji. Next photos, UK Transportation Secretary Grant Shapps beside Vi, a 192-foot superyacht that reportedly belongs to Vitaly Vasilievich Kochetkov and which the UK detained amid new sanctions. In a 2019 letter to Brandon Lewis, then the Conservative Party chairman, Stephen Kinnock, an opposition Labour legislator, expressed his concerns about the troubling connections to the Conservative Party's new Israeli-born treasurer, Ehud Shaleg, which appear to revolve around his business interest in Russia. He also cited Shaleg's purported contact with disreputable characters linked to Russia. He wrote that it seemed extremely important that the Conservatives examine whether or not there had been any activity that required investigation or whether their new treasurer provides an opportunity for the Russian state or other hostile organizations to influence the sovereignty of the Conservative Party, and thereby the nation. Lewis, now the minister responsible for resolving the Gordian knot of Northern Ireland's troubled post-Brexit peace process, warned Kinnock he was risking libel with his accusations. I do not believe Mr. Shaleg should be expected to respond to what I believe is a political fishing exercise, Lewis wrote. Mr. Shaleg's business dealings are properly registered and declared, he added, concluding, I hope my word will be enough to satisfy your doubts. Fast forward to May, the New York Times reported that the UK-headquartered bank Barclays had filed a suspicious activity report to the National Crime Agency, Britain's chronically underfunded version of the FBI, the year before Shaleg became party treasurer. The documents indicated that a February 2018 donation to the Conservative Party of around $630,000 made by Shaleg had originated in a Russian account belonging to his father-in-law. The Conservatives said afterward that all donations comply fully with the law. Suspicious activity reports themselves are rather routine and don't necessarily lead to further investigation. The National Crime Agency received nearly 500,000 of them between April 2018 and March 2019, of which 80% involved banks. A spokesperson for the UK's Electoral Commission said it had looked into the donation and considered whether there had been a breach of the party finance laws that it enforces. We have no evidence that the party has committed an offense and will therefore not be investigating, she said. Around the time Theresa May resigned as prime minister to be replaced by Johnson, she put Shalleg forth for a knighthood. Months later, in early 2020, Sir Ehud donated more than $12,000 directly to Lewis, according to parliamentary disclosure forms. Coincidentally, Lubov Chernikin donated the same amount to him on the same date. A Lewis representative said his donations are properly and transparently declared and published, and that he's never accepted foreign donations as they are illegal. The representative added, in terms of any rationale for specific amounts on specific dates, that question would be better directed at those who donated. Kinnock told Vanity Fair he considered Lewis's letter defending Shalleg a direct and clear example of buying influence, and it had been outrageous for Lewis to warn him against asking legitimate questions. Having read details in the New York Times of the suspicious activity report submitted by Barclays Bank about the transaction, Kinnock remains frustrated by Lewis's response. A businessman who is properly registered and declared does not receive a gift from his father-in-law. That pings around Europe through several different bank accounts, Kinnock told Vanity Fair, and then the next day makes a very substantial donation to the Conservative Party. A lawyer for Shalleg told the Times there was absolutely no basis for linking the funds transfer to Shalleg's political donation. There are many people in this country of Russian origin who are British citizens, Lewis's representative told Vanity Fair. Like any other British citizen, they have the right to donate to political parties, their representatives, and participate fully in our democracy. Late in the spring of 2014, the all-party parliamentary group on Russia gathered for its annual meeting in a small wood-paneled committee room in the Palace of Westminster. A typical RSVP would include two lords, three MPs, and a dog, says Chris Bryant, the former deputy leader of the House of Commons, under the previous Labour-led government and for years an outspoken critic of the Putin government's appalling human rights record. But this meeting, which would address whether to retain or replace Bryant, then the group's chairman, was surprisingly well attended, including by Cameron and Osborne, who turned up alongside many dozens of their conservative comrades. An advocacy group of parliamentarians and political hangers-on had been gathering support in a campaign to oust Bryant. Called the Conservative Friends of Russia, it had launched itself only 2 years prior in 2012, with a party at Russia's London embassy. Carrie Simmons, now Johnson's wife, was among the guests. We ended up having to put somebody on the door because just so many people came through and everybody got to vote, Bryant told Vanity Fair of the parliamentary gathering. It was just extraordinary. The Friends of Russia seemingly succeeded, and Bryant's time chairing the group came to an end, albeit temporarily, as he was re-elected in 2017. Bryant now recalls a dinner event he attended a few years ago with a smattering of U.S. Congressman and Bill Browder, the financier and Kremlin critic whose lawyer, Sergei Magnitsky, was murdered in 2009, inspiring the original U.S. sanctions that would one day be placed on Putin's inner circle. Cameron was there too, he says, and approached his erstwhile opponent with a disarming comment, Bryant remembers. I got it wrong. You were right about Russia. Johnson made a similar acknowledgement recently, parliamentary transcripts show, saying Bryant had been right for a long time on Russia, and he has been vindicated. Another minister called Bryant a dog with a bone on the issue of Russian malfeasance, but insisted the Ukraine invasion meant things had reached a turning point. Bryant isn't convinced. He also remembers how Johnson, as foreign minister, badly fumbled his first meeting with Putin's jowly top diplomat, Sergei Lavrov, as he sought to normalize relations with Moscow. The prime minister has played Neville Chamberlain on Russia since 2014, Bryant says, in reference to the British leader who pursued a policy of appeasement with Hitler in the late 1930s. Johnson is now trying to project leadership with his rhetoric and a much ballyhooed visit to Kyiv, as if to say, let's try and pretend to be a Churchill. Johnson's office responded that he had been front and center of the international response to Putin's barbaric invasion. The UK shuttered the Golden Visa program in February. Interior Minister and Johnson ally Priti Patel said she wanted to stop corporate elites threatening Britain's national security or pushing dirty money around the UK's cities. But as Bryant points out, many of the now sanctioned individuals had by then been granted visas by the same government, even after the annexation of Crimea underlined Putin's brutal territorial ambitions. As Attorney General at the time, Dominic Grieve says he felt Britain's response to the unilateral occupation of Ukraine's Black Sea Peninsula had been inadequate and did not meet the gravity of what the Russians had actually done. Cameron replaced him without explanation months later. The government's sudden recognition this spring was too little too late, Grieve asserts. The fact they've had their assets seized and can't come here anymore is because the security assessment is that they pose a significant risk. They are intimately linked with the Russian leadership. Now, that was obvious before it was done. Victoria Borwick was a Conservative Member of Parliament for Kensington until 2017, and the wife of Geoffrey, the 5th Baron Borwick, one of the few remaining hereditary aristocrats left in Britain's House of Lords. She previously served as Johnson's deputy when he was London mayor and remembers endless meetings about the need for new housing and the challenges of cash-rich foreign individuals outbidding British would-be buyers. Johnson used to argue simply building more homes would solve the city's long-term housing crisis, but his team understood that approach was not a silver bullet. We all said, okay, Boris, there's no point building all these bloody houses if we can't sell them to English people, she recalls. Wealthy overseas buyers wanted brand new, absolutely virgin residential properties and had the cash to put down immediately, Borwick explains. As a developer, why not take the money? Proving Russian ownership of a London home is not always easy, never mind taking the legally binding action to seize such assets. The advocacy group Transparency International UK recently published an analysis of open-source data, including property ownership and court records, leaked information, and journalist investigations that shows around $2 billion worth of UK property has been purchased by Russians who either have links to the Kremlin or are accused of corruption. The majority of the properties are in just three central London neighborhoods, including the Royal Borough of Kensington and Chelsea. When people talk about it as being one of the world's major money laundering hubs, I think that's quite right, says Duncan Hames, who heads policy and programs for the UK arm of the organization. This whole anonymous ownership problem would have fundamentally undermined the sanctions, which the Foreign Secretary is particularly proud of. Various data leaks in recent years have been crucial for NGOs seeking to shine a light. And while admittedly British businesses that serviced Russian wealth, banks, accountants, lawyers, and real estate agents seemed for a long time to have jettisoned their scruples, without better public information, it will be difficult for such London service firms to avoid inadvertently falling afoul of sanctions in future. And that may in turn rely on those that understand such bad behavior best, other outraged Russians. Like Roman Borisovich, a blonde, barrel-chested Columbia University grad who's working as a senior trader at Merrill Lynch and an investment banker at Deutsche Bank. Raised in Moscow by Russian and Ukrainian parents, he returned to the Russian capital to help run a struggling Soviet-era insurance behemoth, and became an early supporter of Alexei Navalny's anti-corruption foundation. Around the time Borisovich's wife was held for an extended period at a Moscow airport while returning from a European vacation in 2012, Navalny cautioned him that he might face Kremlin accusations of spying for Western governments. The banker moved his family right back to London, where they subsequently lived for several years. On their hunt for a new apartment there, a young punk of a real estate broker provoked his ire during a tour of a penthouse duplex next to Dormition Cathedral, seat of the UK's Russian Orthodox Diocese. He was trying to endear himself by saying that his firm deals with Russians all the time, Borisovich recalls of the broker, who told him they had recently sold a $32 million property to one of Russia's regional governors. That's when I looked at him. Would you be saying the same if this was a Mexican drug dealer? Would you be telling people with the same sort of pride that you've done it? The broker went quiet as Borisovich railed about how local officials in Russia were not paid nearly enough, at least not by honest means, to buy an apartment in Knightsbridge, where the most recent data puts average real estate transactions around $4 million. Since that encounter, he has lobbied for transparency. Corruption, Borisovich says, is the cement, and this is the concrete of the foundation of Russia's current government. There is nothing else that holds it together. It has the power to metastasize. The less probity or propriety we have in our system, the more open we are to manipulation and exploitation by ruthless or authoritarian regimes like the one we see in the Kremlin, says Kinnock, who spent several years living in Russia during the mid-2000s. New rules he and others are advocating for would follow a U.S.-style registry of foreign agents and empower independent forensic accountants to perform due diligence on all party donors. We can actually then start to clean up our politics and to protect the integrity of our democracy. And the listener must be aware that this article went to press some time ago, and many internal changes within UK government have transpired since that printing. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Risco, Alfre Woodard, the award-winning actor and activist on Jackknife Jumps, Sailing, and Waving the Baton at the L.A. Phil. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Under sail somewhere with my children, Mavis and Duncan, and my husband, Roderick, with no agenda. What do you dislike most about your appearance? I'm all pieced out about it. Which living person do you most despise? I despise the actions of so many who are willfully endangering the lives of Americans they fear. Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Can I ask you a question? What is your greatest regret? I laughed at a vulnerable classmate's socks in fourth grade. It hurt and surprised her. What or who is the greatest love of your life? My hilarious, exceptional, irreverent, and kind children. When and where were you happiest? Between action and cut. What is your greatest fear? Rats. Which living person do you most admire? My dear friend Eve Plotkin, supervising attorney at the New York Legal Aid Society, head of the family law unit for 25 years. What do you consider your greatest achievement? A jackknife jump into a full front split, repeatedly. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Inefficiency, whiners. What is your greatest extravagance? Traveling well. What is your favorite journey? To the unfamiliar, then returning because of the fellowship formed. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Selflessness. Who are your favorite writers? Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez. On what occasion do you lie? When I have nothing left to give, but people don't accept that. Which talent would you most like to have? Dancing, a la Judith Jameson. What is your current state of mind? Reaching toward balanced. If you could change one thing about yourself, what would it be? I'd like to be 6 feet tall. If you were to die and come back as a person or thing, what do you think it would be? I would not come back. What is your most treasured possession? Whenever I've had one, I've lost it. What is your motto? No one surrenders here. What is it that you most dislike? Racist actions, racist policies, unexamined racist thought. Where would you like to live? New Zealand pulled a little closer. What is your most marked characteristic? The timbre of my voice. What do you most value in your friends? Humor. Who is your favorite hero of fiction? Janie Crawford from Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God. Who are your heroes in real life? Marion Wright Edelman, Grasa Machel, Serena Williams. How would you like to die? Unaware. If you could choose what to come back as, what would it be? The maestro for the L.A. Philharmonic at Disney Hall. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Alfre Woodard. Field of Dreams by Daisy Shaw Ellis, with photograph by Ina Jang, Rolex Datejust 31 watch in oyster steel, white gold, and diamonds. When Rolex launched the Datejust in 1945, it was an everyday watch, a stroke of beautiful efficiency in a busy post-war world. Its name signifying the tiny calendar at 3 o'clock. The new version, with diamonds for pistols on the 24 flowers that blossom across its face, is a wrist corsage of modern femininity. In addition to the blue photographed here amid thistle, the Datejust 31 comes in silver and olive green. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.